express your view of the law as the facts are presented to you in each one of those cases. And then some 12,000 pages from the Sentencing Commission, transcripts of deliberations on important issues. For most of us as elected senators, if people asked what's your philosophy, we'd point to our voting record. You have a record when it comes to court decisions. And this committee, for the fourth time, is delving into everything that you've published as a judge and even before. So would you like to comment at the outset of those who are looking for a label, what your position is on judicial philosophy?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Over the course of my almost decade on the bench, I have developed a methodology that I use in order to ensure that I am ruling impartially and that I am adhering to the limits on my judicial authority. I am acutely aware that as a judge in our system, I have limited power, and I am trying in every case to stay in my lane. And so what I do is I essentially follow three steps. The first step is when I get a case, I ensure that I am proceeding from a position of neutrality. This means that, you know, you get a case and it's about something and it's submitted by certain parties. I am clearing my mind of any preconceived notions about how the case might come out. I'm setting aside any personal views. It's very important that judges rule without fear or favor. The second step is once I've cleared the decks, so to speak, in this way, I am able to receive all of the appropriate inputs for the case. That is the party's arguments. They've written briefs. Sometimes we have a hearing. Sometimes we hear from other parties, amici in a case. And then there's the factual record. I am evaluating all of the facts from various perspectives. I think my experience, all of the various experiences that I've had, really helps me at this stage to see the perspectives of all of the parties and to understand their arguments. And then the third step is the interpretation and application of the law to the facts in the case. And this is where I'm really observing the constraints on my judicial authority. There are many constraints in our system, importantly, because judges have limited authority. And so I am, first of all, looking at my jurisdiction. Threshold matter in every federal case is to make sure that you even have the power to hear the case. In evaluating jurisdiction, you're looking at all sorts of things, the text of a jurisdictional provision, for example, precedent related to it. If I can get to the merits of the case, if I have jurisdiction, then I am observing the limits on my authority concerning the question. So if it is a statute, for example, or a provision of the Constitution, I'm looking at the text. The adherence to text is a constraint on my authority. I'm trying to figure out what those words mean as they were intended by the people who wrote them. So at this point, I'm looking at original documents. I am focusing on the original public meaning because I'm constrained to interpret the text. Sometimes that's enough to resolve the issue in terms of the merits. Judges also look at history and practice at the time of the document was created. If it's a statute, I'm looking at Congress's purposes because, again, I am not importing my personal views or policy preferences. The entire exercise is about trying to understand what those who created this policy or this law intended. I'm also looking at precedent, which is another constraint on judicial authority. I am looking at prior cases and trying to understand what other judges have said as a lower court judge, I'm bound by the precedent. And even in the Supreme Court, if I was fortunate enough to be confirmed, there's stare decisis, which is a binding kind of principle that the justices look at when they're considering precedents. So all of these things come into play in terms of my judicial philosophy.
Another issue which has come up, to my surprise, and I've spoken to my Republican colleagues about their fascination with it, is the notion of the composition of the Supreme Court, which euphemistically is referred to as court packing. I have said on the floor, and I will repeat here, there is exactly one living senator who has effectively changed the size of the Supreme Court. That was the Republican leader, Senator McConnell, who shrank the court to 8 seats for nearly a year in 2016 when he blocked President Obama's nomination of Merrick Garland. Now, that question on court packing was posed to Amy Coney Barrett, justice in the court, when she appeared before this committee. She was asked about it. She said, and I quote, "Could not opine on it." And on many other policy issues, then Judge Barrett said repeatedly she could not share her views, stating, and I quote, "I will not express a view on a matter of public policy, especially one that is politically controversial, because that is inconsistent with the judicial role." I do believe we should have rules and traditions and precedents, but we shouldn't have a separate set of rules for Republican nominees and Democratic nominees. So, Judge Jackson, if a senator were to ask you today about proposals about changing the current size of the Supreme Court, what would your response be?
Senator, I agree with Justice Barrett in her response to that question when she was asked before this committee. Again, my North Star is the consideration of the proper role of a judge in our constitutional scheme. And in my view, judges should not be speaking to political issues, and certainly not a nominee for a position on the Supreme Court. So I agree with Justice Barrett.
Let me address another issue that came up yesterday in the opening phase of this nomination hearing. And it's the issue involving child pornography. I want to turn to that issue because it was raised multiple times, primarily by the senator from Missouri. And he was questioning your sentencing record in child pornography cases that do not involve the production of pornographic material. They're known as non-production cases. I wanted to put some context here. The senator from Missouri has, in his tweets, said of your position on this issue, "Judge Jackson has a pattern of letting child porn offenders off the hook for their appalling crimes, both as a judge and a policymaker. She's been advocating it since law school. This goes beyond soft on crime," the senator said. "I'm concerned this is a record that endangers our children." I thought about his charges as I watched you and your family listening carefully yesterday, and what impact it might have had on you personally to know that your daughters, husband, parents, family, and friends were hearing the charges that your implementation of this law, sentencing, endangered children. Could you tell us what was going through your mind at that point?
Thank you, Senator. As a mother and a judge who has had to deal with these cases, I was thinking that nothing could be further from the truth. These are some of the most difficult cases that a judge has to deal with because we're talking about pictures of sex abuse of children. We're talking about graphic descriptions that judges have to read and consider when they decide how to sentence in these cases. And there's a statute that tells judges what they're supposed to do. Congress has decided what it is that a judge has to do in this and any other case when they sentence. And that statute doesn't say, look only at the guidelines and stop. The statute doesn't say impose the highest possible penalty for this sickening and egregious crime. The statute says calculate the guidelines, but also look at various aspects of this offense and impose a sentence that is, quote, sufficient but not greater than necessary to promote the purposes of punishment. And in every case, when I am dealing with something like this, it is important to me to make sure that the children's perspective, the children's voices, are represented in my sentencings. And what that means is that for every defendant who comes before me and who suggests, as they often do, that they're just a looker, that these crimes don't really matter, they've collected these things on the internet and it's fine, I tell them about the victim statements that have come in to me as a judge. I tell them about the adults who were former child sex abuse victims who tell me that they will never have a normal adult relationship because of this abuse. I tell them about the ones who say, I went into prostitution, I fell into drugs because I was trying to suppress the hurt that was done to me as an infant. And the one that was the most telling to me that I describe at almost every one of these sentencings when I look in the eyes of a defendant who is weeping because I'm giving him a significant sentence. What I say to him is, do you know that there is someone who has written to me and who has told me that she has developed agoraphobia? She cannot leave her house because she thinks that everyone she meets will have seen her, will have seen her pictures on the internet. They're out there forever. At the most vulnerable time of her life, and so she's paralyzed. I tell that story to every child porn defendant as a part of my sentencings so that they understand what they have done. I say to them that there's only a market for this kind of material because there are lookers, that you are contributing to child sex abuse. And then I impose a significant sentence and all of the additional restraints that are available in the law. These people are looking at 20, 30, 40 years of supervision. They can't use their computers in a normal way for decades. I am imposing all of those constraints because I understand how significant, how damaging, how horrible this crime is.
It is. It should be noticed as well that the cases which the senator from Missouri referred to yesterday all resulted in incarceration of some magnitude. In the one case, the Hilly case, I want to quote what you said on the record. This family has been torn apart, speaking to the defendant, by your criminal actions. You saw it on the faces of those women. You heard it in their voices and the impact of your acts on those very real victims who are still struggling to recover this day makes your crime among the most serious criminal offense this court has ever sentenced. And you imposed a sentence of 29 and a half years on that defendant. So the notion that you look at this casually or with leniency, as the senator said, your record belies that. And in fact, what we are dealing with here is an issue which even this committee and members on the committee have been loath to address again. The original law was written at least 9 or 10, maybe longer, years ago, and the quantity of material was relevant to the sentencing. And now that we have computer access to voluminous amounts of material, it has raised questions, has it not, within the judiciary as to the appropriate sentencing in today's circumstances. This was a question that was raised before the Sentencing Commission, was it not?
It was, Senator. The Sentencing Commission has written at least one report, it did when I was there, looking at the operation of this guideline. As you said, the guideline was based originally on a statutory scheme and on directives, specific directives by Congress at a time in which more serious child pornography offenders were identified based on the volume, based on the number of photographs that they received in the mail. And that made total sense before, when we didn't have the internet, when we didn't have distribution. But the way that the guideline is now structured, based on that set of circumstances, is leading to extreme disparities in the system, because it's so easy for people to get volumes of this kind of material now by computers. So it's not doing the work of differentiating who is a more serious offender in the way that it used to. So the commission has taken that into account, and perhaps even more importantly, courts are adjusting their sentences in order to account for the changed circumstances. But it says nothing about the court's view of the seriousness of this offense.
Judge, there have been several news organizations that have taken a look at the senator from Missouri's charges, ABC News, CNN News, The Washington Post, and others, and have concluded that they are inaccurate and unfair to you in their conclusions. In fact, one writer has said they are meritless to the point of unacceptable levels. Nationally, in 2019, only 30% of non-production child pornography offenders received a sentence within the guidelines range, fewer than 30%. Between 2015 and 2020, in the D.C. District Court where you served, judges imposed below-guideline sentences in non-production cases 80% of the time for the reasons you've just explained. Judges in Missouri, the home state of the senator who has criticized your record, did so 77% of the time. One particular judge whom the senator supported to become a federal judge by appointment of President Trump, unfortunately, has a 77% record. I'm going to make sure that this is accurate. Here it is. In the United States versus Klotz, Trump appointed Judge Sarah Pitlick, the senator's choice for the Eastern District of Missouri, sentenced an individual convicted of possession of child pornography to 60 months, well below the 135 to 168-month sentence recommended by the guidelines. She appears to have run into the same issue or same challenge that you have described here. So going forward, in terms of this issue, it seems that we at least share the burden by your interpretation as to define this statute in modern terms, in terms of technology as it exists today. Is that the way you see it?
Senator, Congress is tasked with the responsibility of setting penalties. Congress tells judges what we're supposed to do when we sentence. And what I'd say is that Congress has to determine how it wishes for judges to handle these cases. But as it currently stands, the way that the law is written, the way that Congress has directed the Sentencing Commission appears to be not consistent with how these crimes are committed. And therefore, there's extreme disparity, as you pointed out. There are judges who are varying because our ultimate charge from this body is to sentence in a way that is sufficient but not greater than necessary to promote the purposes of punishment.
Judge Jackson, we've heard criticism from some about your previous work representing detainees at Guantanamo Bay. In fact, for years, we've heard criticisms leveled against lawyers who have provided Guantanamo detainees with legal representation. This criticism misses one critical point. The right to counsel is a fundamental part of our constitutional sentence system, even for the most unpopular defendants. I want to thank Senator Graham, who served as an Air Force lawyer for decades, for offering his perspective yesterday. He said, and I quote, "The fact that you're representing Gitmo detainees is not a problem with me," Senator Graham said. "Everyone deserves a lawyer. You're doing the country a great service when you defend the most unpopular people." And then Judge Roberts said during his confirmation hearing, it's a tradition of the American bar that goes back before the founding of the country that lawyers are not identified with the positions of their clients. The most famous example probably was John Adams, Chief Justice said, who represented the British soldiers charged in the Boston Massacre. This sentiment is shared by lawyers across the political spectrum. I want to give you an opportunity to address this issue because it applies not just to Gitmo detainees, but to your work as a public defender in terms of the wisdom, if not, acceptability of providing counsel in those cases and what impact it's had on you personally in terms of your rulings on the bench.
Thank you, Senator. September 11th was a tragic attack on this country. We all lived through it. We saw what happened, and there were many defenses, important defenses, that Americans undertook. There were Americans whose service came in the form of military action. My brother was one of those Americans, those brave Americans who decided to join the military to defend our country. There are others of you in this body who have military service, and I honor that, to protect our country. After 9/11, there were also lawyers who recognized that our nation's values were under attack, that we couldn't let the terrorists win by changing who we were fundamentally. And what that meant was that the people who were being accused by our government of having engaged in actions related to this under our constitutional scheme were entitled to representation. We're entitled to be treated fairly. That's what makes our system the best in the world. That's what makes us exemplary. I was in the Federal Public Defender's Office when the Supreme Court, right after the Supreme Court decided that individuals who were detained at Guantanamo Bay by the president could seek review of their detention. And those cases started coming in, and federal public defenders don't get to pick their clients. They have to represent whoever comes in, and it's a service. That's what you do as a federal public defender. You are standing up for the constitutional value of representation. And so I represented, as an appellate defender, some of those detainees. In the early days, the legal landscape was very uncertain. This had never happened before, not only the attack, but also the use of executive authority to detain people in this way. And there were a lot of questions that the court was asking. The Supreme Court had taken a series of cases to try to understand what are the limits of executive authority, which is important. All of our liberty is at stake if we don't get it right in terms of what the executive can do. The Supreme Court has recently reaffirmed that the Constitution does not get suspended in times of emergency. And so lawyers were trying to help the court to figure out what the executive's power was in this circumstance. And as an appellate defender, I worked on the habeas petitions of some of these detainees. My petitions were virtually identical because we had very little information. Part of the issue at the very beginning of these cases was that most of the factual information was classified. So defense counsel were appointed to represent these defendants. We had no facts. And I was making legal arguments about the circumstances. That is what gave rise to my representation. And I would just emphasize that that's the role of a criminal defense lawyer. Criminal defense lawyers make arguments on behalf of their clients in defense of the Constitution and in service of the court.
Judge Jackson, those of us who read about the workings of the Supreme Court realize it's a close relationship among the justices. You've seen it personally as a clerk and as an attorney yourself. I'm going to close with one question here that comes to my mind. I was in the House of Representatives when the war on drug measure was passed 30 years ago or so. It was at the advent of crack cocaine. It scared the hell out of us. The notion of a cheap narcotic, highly addictive, destructive to mothers and their fetus led us to impose a sentencing disparity between crack and powder cocaine that was unprecedented, 100-1. Our notion was to come down hard, make it clear that it was a federal standard, impose that standard, and stop the advance of crack cocaine. We failed from the outset. The price of cocaine, crack cocaine on the street went down and up instead of down. Down instead of up. And the number of users went up instead of down. And we found ourselves in a position where we were filling the federal prisons with violations primarily for possession of crack cocaine, hundreds of thousands being incarcerated at the time. I came here to this committee in an effort to try to change it, negotiated a revision of that measure from 100-1 to 18-1 with Senator Jeff Sessions. It was passed by the committee, by the Senate, and by the House of Representatives and signed into law by President Obama. Then you on the Sentencing Commission had to consider what to do with these new guidelines coming from Congress. And you achieved a consensus. I think most people don't realize the Sentencing Commission is a pretty diverse group and very transparent. Could you close in the last minute or so and tell me about that effort to find consensus on an issue that controversial?
Yes, Senator. As you mentioned, the Sentencing Commission is a very diverse group of people who've been appointed by presidents of different parties by law. And at the time that I was on the commission, we had a range of people, judges from different backgrounds, who had different views about the criminal justice system, but we had a directive from Congress insofar as Congress had changed the penalties, as you mentioned, related to crack cocaine. And so we worked together to make a determination about whether or not the guidelines needed to change, and if so, whether or not to impose those changes retroactively. In light of all of the evidence that you point out, all of the Congress's changes, and the need to avoid unwarranted sentencing disparities, which is exactly the charge that this body has given to the commission. And we worked together. We reached unanimous agreement that the change in the guidelines that was necessitated by the change in the statute should apply retroactively to people who had been convicted and sentenced under the prior regime, and then Congress followed shortly thereafter by making it a statutory change to apply those changes retroactively.
Thank you, Judge Jackson. Senator Grassley.
Thank you, Mr.
You're listening
Chairman.
To Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson's Supreme Court confirmation hearings. Judge Jackson was answering questions from Dick Durbin, the top Democrat on the committee, who used his time to preempt some of the criticisms expected from Republican senators on things like how Judge Jackson approached child pornography offender sentencing, her views on expanding the Supreme Court, and her time as a defender of Guantanamo Bay detainees, among others. We're now hearing from the top Republican on the committee, Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa, who's begun his questions now. Let's listen.
Down to the Agriculture Committee for some issues on rural health care. Do you believe? Well, let me ask it this way. Do the First Amendment free speech protections apply equally to conservative and liberal protesters?
Yes, Senator.
Okay. Do you believe the individual right to keep and bear arms is a fundamental right?
Senator, the Supreme Court has established that the individual right to keep and bear arms is a fundamental right.
Could you tell me how you might go about deciding what a fundamental right is under the Constitution?
Well, Senator, I don't know that I can tell you that in the abstract, in the sort of way that you may have posed the question. There is precedent in the Supreme Court related to various rights that the court has recognized as fundamental. The court has some precedents about the standards for determining whether or not something is fundamental. The court has said that the 14th Amendment substantive due process clause does support some fundamental rights, but only things that are implicit in the ordered concept of liberty or deeply rooted in the history and traditions of this country. They're the kinds of rights that relate to personal, individual autonomy, and they've recognized a few things in that category. And that's the tradition of the court for determining whether something is fundamental in that way.
Okay. On another subject, kind of personal to me, over a long period of time, and about half of this committee, but it's a controversial issue even within this committee. I favor allowing Supreme Court hearings to be televised. What's your view on this? How would you feel about cameras in the courtroom? About 45 of our states allow.
Well, Senator, I would want to discuss with the other justices their views and understand all of the various potential issues related to cameras in the courtroom before I took a position on it.
I think that's a fair answer at this point. I'm going to ask you about a bill that I got passed a long, long time ago. And it's something that at some level of court, sometime the district court, sometime at the circuit court, and even once or twice at the Supreme Court, these courts tend to do damage to a bill called the False Claims Act. This bill has brought $70 billion of fraudulently taken money back into the federal treasury since it's been passed. And courts have weakened it, and then Senator Leahy and I usually find ourselves having to pass legislation to say to the courts, you got it wrong. In fact, there's a very controversial bill right now before the United States Senate on that very subject. It's fought fraud in the Department of Defense, healthcare industry, the pharmaceutical industry. $70 billion is pretty important. So when you get, if you're approved to be on the Supreme Court and the issue of false claims comes up, I hope you think of Chuck Grassley. It's one of the, well, and Leahy. Okay. The False Claims Act is one of the best tools that we have to fight against government fraud and to recover taxpayers' money. I've worked for decades to protect whistleblowers who shine a light on fraud, waste, and abuse in the government. So I'd like to ask you a couple questions. And I'm going to start with a former attorney general, unnamed, once suggested that KTAM's suits were in his words, patently unconstitutional, and another word he used was dangerous. He argued that it violated the appointments clause. So, understanding that you may get a case before you on the False Claims Act, but maybe this appointment clause is sound enough, you could answer, do QI-TAM suits violate the appointments clause?
So, Senator, I am not familiar with that representation.
Could you answer in writing then?
Well, I'd be happy to do whatever. I'm just trying to assess.
I'm sorry. I shouldn't have interrupted you.
No, that's all right. Sorry. I'm not familiar with the quotation or what the attorney may have said about them. I know that the Supreme Court has considered various QI-TAM actions and has issued opinions in the area and has not, at least to date, found them to be unconstitutional. But I don't know if that issue has been squarely presented to the court, and I would be loath to comment on it just because if it's being litigated, it's something I wouldn't be able to address.
Let me, on the same subject, also this former attorney general also argued that QI-TAM suits also violate a broader separation of power principles. Can you tell me whether you think the president's constitutional powers are violated when private citizens are allowed to sue in the name of the United States, and that's what QI-TAM suits are all about, private citizens going to court?
Well, Senator, it is an important concern. There are statutes that do allow for the kinds of lawsuits that you are articulating. I am not aware of impediments to those, but again, you know, this is the kind of thing that may be litigated, and I would have to look, as I do, consistent with my methodology, at any arguments that are raised about the constitutionality or lawfulness of those actions.
Remember, in about all of these suits that involve the courts in making interpretations of the False Claims Act, most of them are brought by whistleblowers. And remember, the government would not even know about these fraudulent use of taxpayers without whistleblowers coming forth. And they ought to be given some credit for wanting the government to do what the laws say it ought to do and spend the money the way that the Constitution or that the Congress implies that that money be spent. I want to move on. At an event at the University of Chicago School of Law in 2020, you quoted Martin Luther King Jr., who dreamt of a time when, quote, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners would be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood, end of quote. You talked about how quickly things in the country then changed, including the civil rights laws, over the next few years because of the civil rights movement. You added that, quote, less than a decade after Dr. King's words, that was the world that you inhabited. Dr. King hoped for a country where we would all be judged by the content of our character rather than our race. Do these quotes still reflect your views on this very important topic today?
Yes, Senator. In that speech, I talked about my background, my upbringing, the fact that my parents, when they were growing up in Miami, Florida, attended and had to attend racially segregated schools. Because by law, when they were young, white children and black children were not allowed to go to school together. And my reality, when I was born in 1970 and went to school in Miami, Florida, was completely different. I went to a diverse public junior high school, high school, elementary school. And the fact that we had come that far was, to me, a testament to the hope and the promise of this country, the greatness of America, that in one generation, we could go from racially segregated schools in Florida to have me sitting here as the first Floridian ever to be nominated to the Supreme Court of the United States. So yes, Senator, that is my belief.
And I think it's good that the country had an opportunity to hear what you just told us about your experience. I'm going to go to something that the chairman brought up, and I've written down the three steps you go through another question, but also one that he brought up on court packing and your opinion. I heard what you said, and you said it should be a policy question, but I want to go to something in 2013 during your hearing to be a district court judge. Senator Colborn asked you whether you believed in the theory that the Constitution is a living document whose meaning evolves over time. You said no. In 2021, however, during your circuit court nomination hearing, you declined to answer the same question when asked why the answer to your question of 2013 and not in 2021, in written questions, you noted that you weren't a sitting judge. So please explain to me or describe for us the difference between ethical rules for sitting judges versus judicial nominees who are not already judges.
Senator, I don't know that there are ethical rules that are different. What I'll say is, with respect to my approach to judging, there is not a label, I think, that fits what it is that I do and how I've approached my role. As I mentioned to the chairman, I'm very acutely aware of the limitations on the exercise of my judicial power, and those limitations come in the form of adherence to the text, assuming you even get to that stage of the process, that you have subject matter jurisdiction, you can reach the merits, then you are looking at the text, and I do not believe that there is a living constitution in the sense that it's changing and it's infused with my own policy perspective or the policy perspective of the day. Instead, the Supreme Court has made clear that when you're interpreting the Constitution, you're looking at the text at the time of the founding and what the meaning was then as a constraint on my own authority. And so I apply that constraint. I look at the text to determine what it meant to those who drafted it.
On this same subject, I want to point out a difference between you and a couple people that have sat on the Supreme Court. Justice Breyer said that a structural alteration of the Supreme Court motivated by a perception of political influence can only feed the perception of political influence. That's my parenthetical, further eroding that trust. Justice Ginsburg also cited court packing as being, quote unquote, a bad idea. Court packing is creating new seats for political purposes for a president to appoint more judges. Do you agree with Justice Breyer and Justice Ginsburg that court packing is a bad idea? Before you respond, I'd like to say that you say this question should be left to Congress as a policy issue. I'd reiterate that sitting Supreme Court justices have spoken on that matter. So I don't think it'd be inappropriate for you to do if other people sitting there have said that it's a bad idea.
Well, respectfully, Senator, other nominees to the Supreme Court have responded as I will, which is that it is a policy question for Congress. And I am particularly mindful of not speaking to policy issues because I am so committed to staying in my lane of the system, because I'm just not willing to speak to issues that are properly in the province of this body.
Okay. Then I would interpret your answer, and you don't have to respond to this, but I think you're saying Breyer and Ginsburg should not have stated their views on that issue. During his opening statement yesterday, one member of this committee suggested that the Supreme Court has been bought by dark money groups. Do you agree that the Supreme Court has been bought by dark money groups?
Senator, I don't have any reason to believe that that's the case. I have only the highest esteem for the members of the Supreme Court, whom I hope to be able to join if I'm confirmed, and for all of the members of the judiciary.
Thank you for that answer. I'm going to go to international law. During an ABA panel on international law last year, Justice Breyer said that as a federal judge, quote, you can't do your job properly, end of quote, without considering international law and, quote again, in some cases, and it's a growing number, end of quote, and I assume a growing number of opportunities to use international law. In 2018 op-ed, Justice Breyer said that, quote, the best way to preserve American values may well be to take account of what happens abroad, end of quote. Under what circumstances is it appropriate to consider international law when interpreting our Constitution?
Thank you, Senator. I have nothing but the highest esteem and respect for my former boss, who I've spent the better part of the past couple decades calling my justice, having clerked for him. But I do think that the use of international law is very limited in our scheme and in our judging. There are certain cases in which it is relied upon where Congress directs or where the standards are such. The case involves a treaty, for example, and you have to interpret international law in order to be able to address it. But there are very, very few cases, I think, in which international law plays any role, and certainly not in interpreting the Constitution.
I think you probably have answered my next two questions, but if you say you have nothing to add, I still want to ask the questions. Do you think it's appropriate to look to international law when interpreting enumerated and unenumerated constitutional rights?
No, Senator.
Which specific, again, I think you've answered this, but I want to ask it anyway. Which specific constitutional clauses or rights has the Supreme Court held that can be interpreted by looking to international law?
I'm not aware of any that are properly illuminated by reference to international law.
Yeah. Now I want to go to a question that Senator.
You're listening to Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson's Supreme Court confirmation hearings. This is live special coverage from NPR News.
Judicial philosophy, and you made three points, three steps you take to go through a case and apply the law, and you say you're. Your methodology is limited power and stay within your lane. I'd like to ask you, well, you've served on the district court for several years, and spent 8 months on the D.C. Circuit. During yesterday's opening statement, we heard a lot about the importance of judicial philosophy. In your own words, you've described that, so you don't have to go through that again with me. But if Congress writes a law that does not explicitly allow private parties to sue,